90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
The only good Indian is a dead Indian.
Welcome to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Rhonda, your host here for the next hour. Hope you're enjoying this nice rainfall out there. It's really great. We needed it. We'll get into the music. A good song for you guys, Zuni Buffalo Dance. You're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Hey, KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues, and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
All right, you're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Rhonda, your host here. And yes, if you'd like to volunteer here at KKFI, we'd more than welcome you here. I was at, this past week, we were at a event that we were had a table at, and that was at the Arts Uptown Bar. And we saw the band That Saved the World and met some of our volunteer staff that we had there. So that was really great. Was able to meet some people out there and just had a really good time. So if you want to help us out, we have a lot of events that we got going on, and we always need a helping hand. So again, you can go to the website at kkfi.org and volunteer. All right. Well, we'll get into the music again. I just want to tell you what you were listening to. Cree Confederation. After Beautiful Flower CD, we had Bill Miller with Ghost Dance. And then we had a Zuni Buffalo Dance, the Zuni Nation out there in New Mexico. Okay, well, we got some Southern style music. And this is Alex E. Smith and Thomas Kit Landry and Cheevers Topaw with Southern Man. You're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey,
hey, hey, oh, hey. Southern man, hey oh ha, hey oh ha, oh, and I will hold you all night long. I will sing you sweet love songs. If you love me, take my hand. I will be your Southern man, hey oh ha, hey oh ha,
hey oh hey.
Oh, Trying to find where I belong. love the old way, and it was fun days for me growing up.
Aloha,
mahine hawaii vo,
tasana hohino puhu.
Because, you know, we're talking for the future generations.
I'm Conroy Chino, introducing you to Living Voices, Profiles of Native Americans and Native Hawaiians Today. Frank Dukapu is Hopi and a scientist. As a geneticist, he's become known for his view that science and Native traditional methods are compatible. And he says the lessons he learned from his father at Hopi have guided him his entire life.
It actually began when I was a youngster. I think it was 5 years old when I was sitting in the plaza and my dad, we were watching the Kachina dance. And my folks, my dad especially, because he was Hopi, always used to say, just sit there and think about the dance and open your heart up and your mind up and things will start coming to you, whatever it might be. This is what the dances are for. If you listen with your heart instead of your head, the thing will start falling in place and that'll be the beginning of what your path would be. That's always bailed me out in the different things I've gotten into. Then I found a book in a trash can. It was turned out to be Guyton's book on physiology, and I read that thing from cover to cover, and it just fascinated me. So I got back into science in a big way because that was a college textbook. It was all torn up and everything, and I read it day and night. Couldn't understand a lot of it, but I said I want to get more into this. The thing Dad always used to say, learn. Went off to ASU. So I said, what am I going to do? So that's when a professor came along and had a summer project, which ended up with a master's degree. I was able to find an area like genetics that I really liked. What's important is that during that time, I would take that information back to the reservation and present it to my folks and my grandparents or my godfather and verify, at least get a reaction from them. And it was never very difficult because they would say, yeah, we knew that all the time. We knew about that already. They knew about corn, so my dad would take me out there and show me how the field is laid. It's laid a certain way because the wind blows this way. And then when you plant down so far. He had it all figured out. I mean, these guys know just when to plant, how far to go. Even when they looked through the seeds, he said, this one's no good. And he was saying, this is how you select these seeds. He knew all these things. He didn't have the terminology for it, but he knew the methods and the methodology. It was superb science. So you can say that about any of those Hopi farmers up there. They know all that knowledge of how the plants are and how to hybridize. Here's what I think, and I really believe this as I see what's going on, because I just returned from that meeting at Cold Spring Harbor where they spent, 4 days of intense sharing on human evolution and the Human Genome Diversity Project. I got a sense of some of the people doing it and some of the values they have and some of their worldviews, which really are different from Indian people. Where are we going with all this? And even the scientists don't know, because they're saying we're just doing it now because we got to do it because it needs to be done. But as far as seeing the big picture, see, that's where the Indians come in with these other things that they could share with non-Indians and where the science may fit. This is so important that we can't afford to shy away from science and say it's too hard or it's not the Indian way, because it is the Indian way when you look back in our culture. The science and technology has always been there with the agriculture, the political, the architectural, the ecological. It's a very unique path that I'm following, but I see it now because you still have the roots of your culture over here that you can fall back on. But then going over here in the Western science in this very technical area has been my experience. I feel comfortable in both. You know, I can talk the culture, I can talk the language of the scientists too. So it was like my dad said, I don't know why you're going into this area, but if you like it and you're doing good in it, stay with it, because someday there's a reason for all this. And that's what Hopis think too, that nothing happens by chance. There's always some kind of plan there, and you just got to follow that and follow the spirit.
This interview with Frank Dukapu was conducted by Harlan Makasito. In memory of Dr. Frank C. Dukapu, who passed on the 27th of October, 1999, as the founder of the National Native American Honor Society, he is known to have said, quote, I promise to become educated and use my education for the benefit of my people. These are the words that his daughters, Christine and Remy, remember him by. Living Voices is a project of the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of the American Indian. Executive producers Kevin Lewis and Elizabeth Weatherford. Project coordinator Nan Rubin. Writers Peggy Berryhill and Ginger Miles, mixed at Mercer Street Sound. For more information, check out our website at www.si.edu/NMAI. For Living Voices, I'm Conroy Chino.
All right, you're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Rhonda, your host here. And that was The Living Voices with Frank Dukepoo. And before that, we had Sihasen with Shine. And then we start off with some Southern Man with Alex E. Smith, Jeebus Topaw, and Thomas Kit Landry off their Harmony Nights CD. And we'll get to your news across Indian country. We got some information on the Keystone XL pipeline. A federal judge has told the Trump administration to conduct a more thorough review of the Keystone XL pipeline in response to a lawsuit filed by Native activists. In a ruling this past Wednesday, Judge Brian Moore said the government needs to prepare a supplemental environmental impact statement for the mainline alternative route in Nebraska. The Trump administration has instead released a less stringent environmental assessment on the contested route of the pipeline. Quote, it's an answer to our prayers, faced Spotted Eagle, an elder from the Yankton Sioux tribe, who has been a key player in the fight against the project, told Earther in a reaction to the decision. The Indigenous Environmental Network and the North Coast Rivers Alliance filed the lawsuit in federal court in Montana in March of 2017. They took action after President Donald Trump, just days after taking office, revived the crude oil project and later approved a key permit without consulting affected tribal communities. Quote, because President Trump has turned his back on the Native American community and protection of our clean water, endangered fisheries, and indeed survival of the planet itself, we have asked the federal courts to order him to comply with our nation's environmental laws, Stephen Volker, an attorney for both groups, said in a press release. We believe that the courts will apply and enforce the law fairly and fully and protect our irreplaceable lands and waters and a Native American community that depends on them from the risky and unneeded Keystone XL pipeline. The 1,179-mile pipeline would link the oil fields of Canada's Alberta province to refineries in the United States. The proposed route runs through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska before connecting to existing pipeline infrastructure. Tribes in all three states are opposed to the project. Though the route does not pass through Indian country, it crosses treaty territory in Montana and South Dakota and comes close to at least two reservations in South Dakota. In Nebraska, the mainline alternative route crosses the Ponca Trail of Tears, the path the Ponca people took when they were forced to move to Oklahoma in the late 1800s. It also comes within 25 miles of the grave of Standing Bear, the Ponca leader who returned to Nebraska following the removal and secured a landmark civil rights ruling on behalf of all tribal citizens. The Ponca Tribe of Nebraska and the Ponca Nation of Oklahoma recently reclaimed a parcel of land within the path of the pipeline. The Poncas in Nebraska are also completing the acquisition of 1,200 acres of ancestral territory, including Standing Bear's resting place. We will own that again for our people and have a place where our people can call home and come home, Chairman Larry Wright said over the weekend as the tribe dedicated a statue of Standing Bear installed near Ponca headquarters in Niobrara. The judge's ruling on the Keystone XL pipeline isn't the only one of its kind after the Trump administration rushed the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline through the approval process without consulting tribes. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was ordered to conduct a more thorough review of the impacts on water resources and treaty rights. A revised decision was due on August 10th, but the Army Corps now says it's coming August 31st. So we'll see what happens then. All right. Well, this I believe this one's taking place in Arizona. a proposal for a massive open pit copper mine in the Santa Rita Mountains will be back in court this month as opponents challenge permits for the project, the latest twist in an 11-year battle over the Rosemont mine. The fight pits supporters who say the mine has been studied to death and will bring much-needed jobs to Pima County against opponents who see a flawed review process on a mine in the absolute worst place for environmental and public health threats. It comes as Hudbay Minerals awaits approval of what could be the final step in getting approval for the mine, the Army Corps of Engineers issuance a Section 404 permit. The permit is named for a section of the Clean Water Act regulating the discharge of fill materials into the waterways. The regulatory process that we have is from outside, very time-consuming, said Mike Peterson, public affairs officer for the South Pacific Division of the Corps, but it's necessary to make a decision that balances reasonable development of commerce with water quality. There's a lot of information and a lot of consideration we have to take into account. We want to make the most informed decision that we can stand behind. But while that decision is pending, at least three lawsuits are proceeding that attacked earlier environmental permits issued for the mine. Those suits, one by the Center for Biological Diversity, one by a group called Save the Scenic Santa Ritas, and one by the Paski Yaqui, the Tohono O'odham, and the Hopi tribes, are expected to be in court this fall. They charge that earlier reviews by the Forest Service and Fish and Wildlife Service did not adequately consider the mine's likely impact on environmental and cultural resources. Stu Gillespie, a staff attorney with Earth Justice, which is representing the tribes in their suit against the Forest Service, said the service's recommendation did not go far enough. One of our main arguments is that the final environmental impact statement and the record of decision by the forest supervisor is that he failed to adequately analyze alternatives, Gillespie said. In an emailed statement, Hudbay said the project has been going through a thorough evaluation and that the Forest Service set specific mitigation and monitoring requirements to ensure the impacts of the mine are measured. Any questions about the final EIS impact analysis are a moot point at this time, as they have been managed and responded to by the agencies responsible, said Hudbay spokeswoman. The Rosemont project has gone through this review under the highest level of review required by the federal government. The Department of Interior, Office of Surface Mining, Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, and Fish and Wildlife Service would not comment on the status of the mine. Tribal officials also did not respond to requests for comment. The proposed open pit copper mine would be about 6,500 by 6,000 feet, more than a mile wide in each direction, with a final depth up to 2,900 feet, according to the Forest Service final environmental impact statement on the Rosemont project. Of the 1.96 billion tons that would be excavated from the site, about 700 million tons would be ore, and the remaining 1.2 billion tons would be waste rock. The mine would be in operation for 24 to 30 years, generating an estimated $136.7 million in state and local taxes, while creating a projected 434 direct jobs and 1,200 indirect jobs per year in Pima County alone, the Forest Service report stated. It would be just a shame if projects as consequential as this were to take on some sort of partisan coloring, said Garrett Taylor, the senior vice president for government and communications at the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. He noted that 17 government agencies have a hand in approval of the permit. We believe it's a worthwhile project and will do tremendous good for the region and the state, Taylor stated. Copper mining is incredibly important to the legacy of the state. But critics say no amount of economic benefit can outweigh the potential environmental damage of the mine. It is the absolute worst place you could pick to put an open copper pit mine in terms of all the impacts to endangered species, threats to Tucson's water supply, and all other issues, said Randy Saragilo, a conservation advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity. Representative Raul Grijalva from Tucson said, while Hudbay talks about the economic benefits of the mine, it ignores its negative environmental impacts that will cause irreparable damage to wildlife habitats, water quality, and land. So that'll be interesting to see where this goes, that's going to be a humongous open pit. All right, so this past week we saw some more primaries, and those were in Minnesota. And we have Mark Trahant's update, and you can look at that up. He posts, and he does a live blog the night of the primaries. If you guys don't know that, follow him on Twitter, follow him on Facebook, Indian Country Today, MediaNetwork.com. You can find his information as well. But this is from his blog. Minnesota is certain to elect a Native American woman as its next lieutenant governor. Then the office of lieutenant governor has an interesting history. In some countries, the lieutenant governor is the official representative of the sovereign. That would be the king or queen. Some lieutenant governors are largely ceremonial. Some are private, close confidants to the governor. Others have actual jobs with a portfolio of responsibilities. Five states, Arizona, Maine, New Hampshire, Oregon, and Wyoming, don't even bother with the post. And in Minnesota, the two-party nominees for lieutenant governor are Native. Republican Donna Bergstrom, a Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, and Democrat Peggy Flanagan, White Earth Nation, joined their running mates Tuesday and secured a line on the November ballot. Bergstrom is running with Jeff Johnson, and Flanagan with Tim Walz. What a year. Let's put this in perspective. Two Native women are party nominees for Congress. One more, Amanda Douglas, Cherokee, has a primary at the end of this month. Deb Holland, Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico, and Sharice Davids, Ho-Chunk in Kansas. Two Native women are party nominees for governor. That's Democrat Paulette Jordan, Coeur d'Alene in Idaho, and Republican Andrea Tupola, Native Hawaiian in Hawaii. Four Native women are lieutenant governor nominees. Deborah Call in Alaska, Anastasia Pittman Seminole in Oklahoma, and now two of them will face each other in November. I could not make this up. Not that this election is a perfect landscape for Native American women. Tuesday night, Arvina Martin was defeated in her primary bid for Wisconsin's Secretary of State. But, and this is important, she took on an incumbent in a primary who could do that. Actually, there's a history to that. Ada Deer once ran for Secretary of State in the same state. Make that twice in Congress. Deer lost all those races, but had a successful political career as serving as Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the Interior Department, the first woman to do so. So we're going to see, again, that's going to be pretty exciting. Either way, a Native woman will be the next lieutenant governor for Minnesota. So, again, and there's another primary come up, so we'll make sure we update you on that as well. Okay, one more story. This is pretty interesting. NBA All-Star Kyrie Irving will be honored in a homecoming ceremony on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation on Thursday, August 23rd, 2018. That's next week. The celebration and ceremony will begin at 9 a.m. and will include a naming ceremony, performances, and a community feed. The event is open to the public. Irvin is a professional basketball player for the Boston Celtics of the National Basketball Association, NBA. Kyrie was named the 2012 NBA Rookie of the Year after being selected by the Cleveland Cavaliers with the first overall pick in the 2011 NBA Draft and became an NBA champion in 2016 with the Cleveland Cavaliers. As part of the Team USA basketball squad, he also earned an Olympic gold medal in the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. In addition to basketball, Irving is an actor, designer, and father. The family connection to Irving comes from the White Mountain family, also known as Mountain of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The White Mountain family comes from the Bear Soldier District on the South Dakota side of the reservation. His late mother, Elizabeth Ann Larson, was adopted out of the tribe when she was a child. Irving's grandmother is the late Meredith Marie Mountain, who is a citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. His great-grandfather is Moses Mountain, and great-grandmother is Edith Morissette Mountain. During the Standing Rock resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, Irving gave his support to the water protectors. Irving recently released a Nike N7 shoe that he designed to honor the water, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and his late mother. Additionally, he has a tattoo of the Standing Rock Sioux tribal logo on the back of his neck. Irving is very proud to be Lakota and to be from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. Quote, we could not be more excited. He has made us all proud to know that he has not forgotten his roots and is taking the time before he starts his basketball season to visit the people, his people, show that Kyrie has a great character and pride in his heritage. That was Standing Rock Sioux tribal chairman Mike Faith saying that. So that's going to be really interesting to see that. I can't wait. I hope they live stream that. That should be interesting. All right, we'll get back into the music and got some Indigenous queued up for you guys. Things we do. You're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Thank you. bones of my history rise to greet me, and the bones of my family rise to greet me. It is 1982. I used to climb the mesa in Grandma's backyard, vertical shadings of torn sandstone rising from the roses tended by her paper-thin hands, looking west, Blue Mountain, looking east, Gawake, Guishji, the ancient home where her bones were planted. See, the family name was Atsi, a remnant of Spanish assimilation. In the 1800s, the Scots moved across the country. Strange blood mixed with her old ways, and round down, three generations down, I stand at the edge of the table where the earth shifts a million years apart, leaving 5 feet of spiderweb cracked empty space for me to jump across. But at 5 years old, I could not use my legs. I could only stare at the great divide that separated me from my home. And the bones of my family rise to greet me. Now, the old-time non-Hispanic families in Laguna were Marmon, Pratt, and Gunn. Great-grandma fell for the tartan and the name changed. Gunn to Haynes, to Gottlieb, to Francis, to now. Staring across the void at 29, grandma's roses are gone. The old house turned over and buried in scorched sandstone at the base of her breast. The petals fall away and less remember her mother, her name, her trip to Carlisle Indian School, her piano playing, her chili stew, her house, her roses, her mesa, and the cracks in the stones reminds me of how little I know and how little remains. And the bones of my history rise to greet me. It is 2003. I am coming home. I am Little Oak Clan. I am the prodigal son journeying straight out of Luke 15, and I am Americana, Americana, the white guy, standing before children who share my blood, giggling, laughing, leering as my tongue trips on East Coast accented barbed wire. I am 29 years old, and I can't even count to three. One, two, three. Ishka, Tidit, Chimage, I am Americana, mixed blood authority figure coming home to play Indian on the Riz, and the whispers behind my back are in front of me in Carice and laughing at Indian jokes I haven't heard in 20 years. My ears have lost the words and my skin betrays me, leaving me defensive in posture, suspicious in nature, ready to fight my own DNA, my own familial indiscretions that bore me under Oshratz, Bawach, Sunfather, Moonmother, and I point to the past, but youth have vague memories and short reflections of elders they never met and roses that fell from the vines before Creator endowed them with the only thing I ever wanted, beauty. The brown skin and smooth tongue that makes them Hanukkah wake, not some mixed up, mixed down, mixed blood Americana who lasts his family to the cracks in the mountains and the mesa and sepia toned roses in the hands of the sky. And the bones of my ancestors rise to greet me. It is 2006. I am home. I am Kapaniwaschi. One, two, three. Ishke, kue, chemie. My mouth and tongue begin to remember, and I am still Americana, but now with streaks of rose petals in my blood. And I am 5 years old, learning to walk on the stones again. When my students say kuatsi, I say ha, atutimo. Now the cracks in the mesa is not so wide, even though I know it will always be there. And for that I say, tawae. Thank you, grandmother.
KKFI is a non-commercial radio station. That means we receive financial support from our community marketing partners. These partners share information about their organization or event while supporting KKFI's mission. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
All right, it's about my time to be getting out of here, and Sunset Reggae is coming up for you next, so make sure you stay tuned for that show, and I'll be leaving you off with some Tanisha Begay. And you were just listening to Lee Francis doing his Crack in the Mesa spoken word, and then Things We Do by Indigenous. Everybody have a wonderful week, and I will see you again next Sunday.
with you, I feel so free.